This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. A few years ago, I spent an entire day moderating discussions between environmental activists, local government officials, and gas and oil industry leaders about fracking. It was exhausting. Fracking, as you might know, is the common term for hydraulic fracturing. It's a method of extracting oil and or gas from shale deposits. There's a new book about fracking. The title is The Fracking Debate, The Risks, Benefits, and Uncertainties of the Shale Revolution. The author is Daniel Ramey, and he joins me now. Welcome.
Thanks so much, Lester. Great to be with you.
So one of the things I often hear is that Michigan has been using hydraulic fracturing for many decades. And that's true, but most of that was vertical hydraulic fracturing. The debate over fracking recently began when drillers started using horizontal hydraulic fracturing. Can you explain the difference to us?
Sure. Hydraulic fracturing is a type of well stimulation. It's something that's done to an oil and gas well after it's been drilled. And it's been going on really for decades, starting in the middle of the 20th century in Kansas and Oklahoma and expanding to other parts of the United States over the decades. In Michigan, there has been hydraulic fracturing applied to vertically drilled wells, as you say, for decades. But in the last 10 or 15 years, companies have gotten better at combining hydraulic fracturing with horizontal and directional drilling. So instead of just drilling down into a shale formation or another type of rock, companies drill down and then sideways for 1, 2, maybe even 3 miles into the rock formation, and that allows them to access a larger deposit of oil and gas. It could be more economical to produce.
So exactly what is hydraulic fracturing? I mean, I understand it's hydraulic, so it must include some kind of fluid and pressure, but what happens from there?
So the way hydraulic fracturing works is that at the surface, after a well has been drilled, a variety of trucks and equipment are moved into place, and they mix a fluid together of large volume of water. Typically, water makes up 95 to 98% of the mixture with sand and chemicals. Those chemicals are often very controversial because not all of them are always disclosed. So that's one important point of contention. The purpose of the sand is to, after the water has been pumped into the rock to create fractures in the rock formation, the sand stays behind to keep those fractures open. And oil and gas can flow through those fractures into the wellbore and then up to the surface. The purpose of the chemicals that are mixed in with the fluid are varied. Typically, there are 5, 10, 15 different chemicals that are added to the fluid, and they perform functions such as killing bacteria that might be found deep underground or preventing buildup within the
well. Why would
they
need to kill bacteria?
In some cases, the fresh water that is pumped deep into the well actually has bacteria in it. And so you don't want to be injecting live organisms down into the rock formation because those organisms have the potential to inhibit production from the well itself. And so each of these chemicals play a different role in basically making it easier and preventing problems from occurring downhole.
You explained in your book that this was originally called slick water. There's a lubrication that's involved here. Water would seem to be a lubricant enough in most cases, not here.
Yeah, normally you would think that water is a slippery enough fluid to do the job. But if you imagine spilling a glass of water on your kitchen floor and how slippery that is, and then imagine spilling a glass of motor oil on your kitchen floor and imagining how much more slippery that is, it gives you a sense of how water might actually not be the best lubricant when you're going deep underground at very high pressures and very high temperatures. And so different chemicals are added to increase the ability of these fluids to move underground.
And it's usually viscous, so it kind of suspends the sand particles, right?
That's correct. Okay. The sand is suspended in the fluid as it's pumped down, and then much of the sand stays behind to keep those fractures open.
So we know that different drillers use different hydraulic fluids, but what kind of chemicals are used? I've heard things like kerosene and other kinds of things like that that just don't sound like something we should be pumping underground.
Well, the original hydraulic fracturing treatments that were performed in Kansas and Oklahoma actually used gasoline and napalm. So companies have been injecting potentially hazardous chemicals underground for a long time. And some of the chemicals that are included now can also be toxic if encountered at large quantities. The concern is that some of these chemicals that are injected deep underground might find a way to migrating towards the surface and getting into people's drinking water. However, we've really seen very little evidence of that around the country, even though hydraulic fracturing has been deployed for decades. There are other risks that come with the process, but chemicals from hydraulic fracturing, there's really only one or two cases in the United States where we have good evidence that those chemicals have actually negatively affected groundwater supplies.
And when that happened, was that it leaking up through bedrock, or was that at the source of the wellhead where there's more opportunity for that stuff to escape?
Typically, the risks that you have associated with fracking chemicals occur at the surface. So when people are handling those chemicals at the surface, mixing it into the water, mixing it in with that fluid that we're talking about, some of it can be spilled either at the well pad or maybe from a truck that is transporting it from a well site to somewhere else.
So that's the other thing. What happens to this fracking fluid? Does it stay under there? Do you pump it back out? What do you do with it if it's got toxic chemicals in it?
Well, this depends based on where you are in the country and what type of rock formation you're injecting into. But a large proportion, you know, maybe at least 20% of the fluid that you originally inject comes back up to the surface. And even more important than the fracking fluid that comes up to the surface is the water that's actually found naturally deep underground with oil and gas deposits. All oil and gas wells, whether or not they're hydraulically fractured, produce a lot of water. That water is naturally high in metals, it's high in salts, and it's the sort of thing you can't just put into a typical water treatment plant. And so what companies do, both with the water from fracking and also with this naturally occurring produced water, is they have to manage it. There are a couple different ways to do that. One, and the most common way to manage this wastewater is actually by injecting it deep underground into what are called wastewater disposal wells.
Or deep injection wells. So you take it out of one hole and you put it in another hole and forget about it. That's basically what we're talking about.
That's basically what we're talking about. And the EPA, along with state governments, have actually been regulating these injection wells for decades. Most of them have operated without major problems. There are a couple cases that are out there where these injection wells themselves have led to pollution incidences of groundwater as well as spills at the surface. So they're not free of risks themselves.
Let's back up just a little bit. We've all seen the movies where someone just drills down, the oil spurts out of the ground through the derrick. So why is fracking even necessary?
If you imagine a movie like There Will Be Blood or a movie like Giants, where you see these enormous volumes of oil shooting up from underground, all of that oil is being produced by natural pressure deep underground. So the types of rocks that companies are drilling down into, they're not drilling into like reservoirs or pools of oil. All of this oil is and gas is contained within different rock formations. But some rock formations are spongier than others. Water and liquids can move more easily through some rock formations than others. In the old days, those big spurting wells were drilled into formations where oil flowed very freely. Those are called permeable rocks. The oil can move easily through them like a sponge. But the types of rocks that companies are drilling into now are much less permeable. Oil and gas flow much less easily through them. And so what companies need to do to unlock that oil and gas from those impermeable rock formations is create this artificial network of fractures, which is where hydraulic fracturing comes in. Those fractures allow the oil and gas to actually have pathways to move through that impermeable rock.
There was a film, a documentary that was released a few years ago, and in it, and I think a lot of people have seen this film or at least a clip of the video from it, when someone holds a flame to a faucet and it catches fire, there's methane in the water, and they blame that on fracking. First of all, was fracking the cause of that? Second, does that happen naturally?
This is a complicated question, and I want to answer it in two parts. So first, the first part is, methane can get into groundwater because of improper cementing and casing of oil and gas wells. So if you drill a natural gas well, methane is coming up through that well. Methane is essentially the same thing as natural gas. If there are defects or cracks in the pipes of that well or in the cement that surrounds those pipes, then the methane can escape from the well and get into groundwater. There are over 300 cases in Pennsylvania alone where this has happened, and it's well documented. So in some cases, methane migration, or sometimes people call it stray gas, can negatively affect water supplies and cause that water to be flammable. Now, the second part of the answer is, as you suggest, this can also happen naturally. So there are many parts of the country where groundwater naturally has a high concentration of methane in it. So just because someone lights their water on fire doesn't mean that oil and gas or fracking were involved. It can actually come from both natural and man-made sources.
So you said more than 300 cases in Pennsylvania. I mean, it sounds like it's not uncommon to happen.
It's not uncommon. There are hundreds of articles in petroleum engineering journals about how you deal with this problem and how you try to prevent it by correctly drilling, casing, and cementing your well. But like any human endeavor, there are errors. And when I say 300 issues in Pennsylvania, let me put that in context. So in 2010 in Pennsylvania, a little bit fewer than 1% of the new shale wells drilled had some problem associated with methane migration or stray gas. So a little bit less than 1% of these wells were causing these types of problems. As time has gone on and Pennsylvania has updated their regulations, companies have gotten better at doing this type of activity. In 2015, the most recent available year, there were 800 new shale wells drilled and actually zero new cases of this type of contamination.
And when you say regulations, you mean basically the pipe and the casing that you're talking about that goes underground. They just updated to a better set of regulations on how those are built.
That's right. There's a whole chapter in my book about how oil and gas development and fracking is regulated. Many people have the perception that fracking is unregulated, and that's because there are very few regulations of the activity by the federal government. But state governments have a variety of regulations that they apply to the oil and gas industry, including what types of steel they need to use, what types of cement they need to use, and a variety of other regulations.
So we've been moving to natural gas. Natural gas prices have gone down a lot. We'll talk about that in a little bit. But one of the benefits the natural gas industry notes is switching a power plant from coal, burning coal, to burning gas means a substantial reduction in greenhouse gas emissions. What do we know about that?
This is, again, a complex issue. It's true that as natural gas production has surged over the last 10 years or so, the natural gas prices have gone down, and that's led to natural gas displacing coal in the electric power sector. Largely because of that displacement, U.S. carbon dioxide emissions are today down to their early 1990s levels. And that's a serious win in the fight against climate change. But there are other issues that we need to take into account. One of them is the concern that methane, which, as you remember, is the main component of natural gas, is by itself a powerful greenhouse gas.
And if it's leaking out to get in your water, it's leaking out into the atmosphere as well in some cases.
That's right. And there are over 2 million miles of natural gas pipelines in the United States. There are tens or hundreds of thousands of oil and gas wells around the United States. Any of those locations could be places where methane leaks. And so methane leaks have been a major interest for researchers, including myself, over the last 5 years or so. And people have been trying to get a handle on how much methane is actually leaking and does it negate the benefits that we get from displacing coal in the electric power sector. And to basically summarize that research very simply, there are a few studies that find in specific locations, methane emissions are very high. If those locations were representative of the entire United States, we'd have a serious problem on our hands. But when you survey the full breadth of the research on methane emissions, what my analysis suggests is that the amount of methane escaping from the natural gas system is not enough to negate the climate benefits of switching from coal towards natural gas.
But it still reduces that 50% figure we've been talking about, that there are 50% less emissions going from coal to natural gas. It sounds like that's not as rosy as we've been led to believe. A fair number of environmentalists say fracking is merely prolonging our reliance on fossil fuels. They don't think switching from coal to gas is how we should be investing in our energy future. They want renewable energy, electricity storage solutions, more efficient buildings and appliances and transportation. How is fracking affecting our energy future?
Again, this is a tricky question, and it's an extremely important one when we think about the challenge of climate change. There have been a number of studies that look at the effects of natural gas, not just on displacing coal, but also competing with renewables, competing with nuclear power, and other energy technologies that can help us transition towards a lower carbon economy. And what many of those studies find is that if you compare a hypothetical world where the shale revolution never happened with a hypothetical world where the shale revolution did happen, that's more like our real world, and you project out 20 or 30 years into the future using economic modeling tools and atmospheric modeling tools, those two futures actually don't look that different because many of the benefits that we get from displacing coal in the electric power sector are partly offset by the competition of natural gas with renewables and with nuclear, as well as the fact that low natural gas prices and low oil prices encourage people to use more energy. And when people use more energy, emissions of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases goes up.
I was going to ask you about that because natural gas and gasoline are both lower than they were before the advent of hydraulic fracturing. So
that's right.
Is it helping the U.S. economy or is it not helping the U.S. economy?
It is helping the U.S. economy. I think there's very clear research that both on the local scales where oil and gas development is occurring and also at the national scale because of these lower prices that we are all paying both at the pump and also in our utility bills through using natural gas as well as electricity, most American households have saved more than $1,000 each in energy costs because of the shale revolution. When you look at the local scale, and I've visited many oil and gas producing regions in the last 4 or 5 years, if you go to a place like Western North Dakota or West Texas or Central Oklahoma or, you know, many of the hundreds of communities where oil and gas production is an important part of the local economy, these communities have experienced major benefits from the shale revolution, but they are also dealing with volatility and challenges of being heavily reliant on an industry that's reliant on volatile oil and gas prices.
Boomtowns.
That's right. There are a number of places in North Dakota that I visited where, you know, the population 10 years ago was 10,000 people, and today the population is 25,000 people. And there are a variety of challenges that go along with that, expanding roads, expanding water infrastructure. Some of these places have seen increased rates of crime, increased drug use. So there are benefits and drawbacks to living in these communities.
Let's look at the big picture. It's said that fracking has made the U.S. more energy independent. We don't have to rely on foreign oil, for example. How true is that?
Well, it's certainly true that U.S. oil imports have gone down substantially. The U.S. is now exporting about 2 million barrels of crude oil each day. That's more than we've ever exported before. But the idea of energy independence, to me, is actually kind of the wrong one to think about. Any economy, including the United States, that uses a large amount of oil can never be independent of the global oil market. That's because oil prices are set on a global basis. If there's a war tomorrow in Saudi Arabia, oil prices are going to go through the roof. That will negatively affect the United States, or at least the drivers and energy consumers of the United States, regardless of how much oil the U.S. is importing or exporting.
So what I hear is we're still reliant on a good dose of Middle Eastern oil.
We're reliant on a global market in which Middle Eastern oil and other oil is important. The only way to be independent of a product is to not use that product.
The book is The Fracking Debate, The Risks, Benefits, and Uncertainties of the Shale Revolution. The author is Daniel Ramey. He's a senior research associate at Resources for the Future, and he teaches energy policy at the Ford School of Public Policy at the University of Michigan. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia and engineered by Peg Watson. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Joy Horan, Gabriel Horton, Sarah Leeson, Sophie Sherry, and April Van Buren. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening.